Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world. It's episode 40 of Game On with Cody and John. On this episode's big deal, those who can't teach. We'll talk about how to teach the rules to your favorite game. And on this episode's Buy, Try, or Deny, Tobago. Will you find buried treasure, or will it just be trash? All this and much more on Game On with Cody and John. Well, howdy gamers, it is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. We're a podcast about all sorts of tabletop games, board games, card games, and role-playing games. Coming to you from beautiful and springy...
Balmy
Indianapolis, Indiana.
Yeah, it hit 60 degrees today. It's raining, so...
Which makes you a happy guy.
Makes me happy, and I didn't wear a coat today. It feels wonderful.
I didn't either. I had just my hoodie and over my very dashing Texas t-shirt that I'm wearing tonight.
It is a t-shirt, yes. Yeah. And spring training has started.
That's right. Your Cincinnati Reds ready to tackle the... Yeah. What was I going to say, really?
Ready for a fourth place finish in the National League Central, as per usual.
End up in the middle, yeah.
So to get our minds off that depressing theme, we have games.
That's kind of what we do here.
That's our bailiwick.
So what are we going to be talking about in our big deal today, Cody?
We're going to be talking about something I'm really bad at, and that is teaching... I can't even talk about it. Teaching game rules.
Yeah, I think I'm equally bad at it, but I like doing it, so I subject the listeners to that every single episode. But we're going to talk about techniques for rules teaching, and when you have a brand new game that you want to teach, what's the best way to go about relaying that information to your audience.
Right, and then in our Buy, Try, or Deny, we have a new game. We have Tobago.
That's right. This is a... kind of bordering on a Euro-style game. Cody actually sat down and played it.
I will play any game once.
Once, right? But yeah, this
I
is
played
a,
Puerto Rico once.
This is a very interesting sort of pseudo-deduction game we'll get there.
Yeah, so maybe we can afford Trinidad after this episode.
Perhaps. We can put them all together there.
That's right.
But as always, our episode will start off with the Game On Inbox, which starts...
now. The Game On Inbox.
Send us an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Do it. All right, it is the Game On Inbox, and as we always do, we will start it off with a little sponsor love, our sponsor, Myriad Games, and John's going to give you a little skinny on him.
A little skinny?
Did I get a little gangster? give him the skinny, Lou!
There's very little that I can offer a skinny on. Okay. I'm not a small person. But Myriad Games is the sponsor of Game On with Cody and John. They sponsor us on behalf of all friendly professional game stores everywhere. You can check them out at myriadgames.com. And we've been talking for the last few weeks about their MVP program, which is sort of you pay a certain amount every month and you get lots of cool benefits in addition to store credit at Myriad Games. And we just recently joined the MVP program and got our first shipment.
It was exciting.
Very exciting. And the level that we joined at, we get one free shipment per month. So that was neat. And it was packed with all kinds of gaming goodness. So we each picked up a couple of items. And then we also got a game through the GameShare program where we're going to be able to rent a game and play it and maybe send it back to them if we're not interested in purchasing it. And we won't tell you what that game is, and if we like it, then we'll probably review it on the show. If we don't, then we'll never mention it again.
Carcassonne the Catapult.
That was not it. But anyway, check out MyriadGames.com. They've also got great podcasts called Myriad Games Presentations that you can find on iTunes or on their website. So thanks again to Myriad Games.
Thank you, Dan.
Let's move on to games that we've been playing. Cody, what have you been playing?
Kind of a lean week, or lean 2 weeks compared to the last one. But
To keep in mind that we're actually recording this a little earlier than we normally do our episodes.
That's true.
Because we have HoosierCon coming up this weekend, which by the time this episode drops, HoosierCon will have just finished. So we're recording a few days early, so probably not quite as much gaming going on as in previous episodes.
Yeah. Played some War Machine with John. He tested out some new units of his Minoth forces. I still just have the battle box from K-Dor. I'm taking a little slower. We played that, and a couple of my friends have been getting into it and painting minis, and that's kind of been exciting to watch. Too bad they're not playing K-Dor, though. I'm the only guy playing.
And you're winning a lot.
That's true. Coincidence? I think not.
Yeah, because I tried out all those nice Menoth guys, like my choir of Menoth, and it was not effective.
Yeah. I've also been playing a lot of Dominion. Like I said, I'm doing two Dominion tournaments, and I've kind of been getting myself ramped up for it. I played a little bit. My in-laws came in from Chicago for a week, and we played some Dominion there. And then I've also tried out that Brit Spielwelt, the German kind of online thing.
Yeah?
Yeah. And
how is it?
It's good. It was surprisingly easy to use, and I've been doing pretty well on it. I mean, I got shellacked in a few games, but I've held my own. So,
huh? You're gonna have to educate me on how to get signed up for that,
because I shall.
I've never really used any of those online interfaces for gaming, but I hear they're pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty.
Well, Magic Online have done that.
Yeah,
a little different.
But that's about all I've played. So
that's all you've got to. Huh?
That's all I've got to.
Well, that's a lot. I'm sure you played a
this
thousand...
weekend is going to be big.
Yeah, lots of Dominion, right?
Lots of Dominion. So, John, what have you been playing?
Well, like you mentioned, we played a good bit of War Machine, a couple of games of that, and it's been fun because as we're still doing, I guess, what you would call learning games. We talked in previous episodes about whenever you play a game for the first time, the first game is always that kind of slog of a learning game. Well, our first few games of War Machine have been sort of like that, just because there's so many different rules. And this past game, we actually made a point to start using the power attacks that you can use, where you can like pick up more jacks and throw them across the table and push and those kind of things. So that just sort of involves, you know, using a lot of those rules and knowing, and you have to look those up a lot. So, but we're slowly getting it, and I think we're going to get to a point pretty soon where we're not going to need to look up things nearly as often. A lot of Dominion for me as well. We still play that at lunch. I actually played a game of Dominion Intrigue today at lunch and won.
Ooh, well,
53 points.
Look at you.
That's pretty big.
Big man on campus.
That's right. And that always makes Single L a little bit irritated, because Single L plays like a World Series of Poker player. He doesn't say a word when he plays. He doesn't really have any facial expression whatsoever. And his turns are so quick, because he's always thinking about, he always knows what he's going to do.
That's how I am. I'm always the guy that the person after me is kind of ticked, because I just go real fast. I'm kind of quiet. And
that person's still shuffling.
And they're like, geez, slow down, man.
Yeah, so I think secretly he was a little irritated that I had beaten him, even though he said, you know, oh, good game. The other thing that I've been doing is a little experiment, and this was inspired partially by Rafe Hollywood Granger from the D6 Generation, who had talked on his show about how he has, like, I think an 8 or 9 year old son that he was trying to teach to play Descent. But instead of playing Descent with the full Descent rules and all that goes along with that, he was sort of simplified it and made it more of like a role-playing game. And so still use all the dice mechanics and things like that and all the monsters, but he would just sort of set up a dungeon and just have the monsters in there, you know, not really play with like an overlord deck or anything like that, but just run it more like a dungeon master. And so I decided to give this a shot with my two kids, because I've got, you know, an almost 7-year-old and an almost 4-year-old, and this 4-year-old little girl who is more about princesses than she is about dungeons. But we had a great time. We've actually played twice now, and we just played the initial dungeon Into the Dark that comes with Descent, and then I just sort of made up my own dungeon for the second time, where they have to fight the brother of the guy who they beat the first time. And they had
the brothers Durnog.
Well, this wasn't the brothers Durnog, actually, because the first one is Narthak, and so I just made up a brother for him.
Ted.
Baldar. I don't know. I just made that up. And they had a great time. And, you know, for a 4-year-old, you know, she's not really able to figure out what dice to throw or whatever, but I can just sort of hand her the dice. She can roll them. And we can figure out. She was even actually getting pretty good after a while at counting up all the hearts on the dice to know what the damage was. So they both were very engaged in it. And afterwards, you could just tell it was a real rich role play sort of experience for them. And they had a great time. So, you know, a great opportunity to play a game that I love that's complex, but in a way that that my young kids can really participate in. So that's,
you got to get them young.
that's right. So I think that's a real good suggestion. Rafe, thanks so much for that. And probably be continuing that in the future. Although I do want to kind of get some Road to Legend out and start playing with the big boys at some point.
You know, there's kind of a funny story somewhat related to that. When I was growing up, when I was about maybe 9 or 10, I think, roughly, Hero Quest came out, you know, the game that's pretty highly sought after now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was an only child growing up, and I saw like a commercial for it or something, and I asked for it, you know, for a birthday, and I got it. But of course, you know, I was 10, I didn't really get the rules, and, you know, I didn't really have anyone to play with, so, you know, I'm just made up things myself. I tried to learn it, but it was just kind of over my head. Mm-hmm. And now I just wonder if I would have kept that game
That would have been cool. We could have played it.
It would have been cool, and it actually worth a little something, I think.
I think so, if you'd kept it nice, yeah. I think about games like Fortress America.
Mm-hmm.
That's one that came out, I think, in the 70s or 80s or something like that, and that would have been a really cool. I wonder if someone would remake that one, but I think if you have an intact copy of Fortress America, that's worth a pretty penny. So, all right, well, that's pretty much all I've been playing.
Okay, so we have some listener emails coming up.
We do. We're getting more and more these days, and we do very much appreciate those who write into the Game On Inbox. Yep.
I'll go ahead and lead off.
Go for it.
All right. Hey, Cody and John. Hey. One of the things I did for the event games is to create a website to keep track of Descent campaign information between sessions. It helps with the setup time, since lots of information is available on the website. It's located at www.descentcampaigntracker.com if you want to check it out. And a list of features is at that same website. Just go under /help/features. Thanks for the great podcast. Keep up the good work. Stephen Yackel.
Wow, very cool.
It was a cool website.
You had a chance to go and check out that website,
yep.
Right?
We got this email today, I believe. So I checked it out, and yeah, it's pretty slick. I think that coupled with the rules that are in the game itself would really make for a pretty easy game experience.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, and that Descent campaign, I mean, there's a whole bunch of games that I want to get to the table and role-playing campaigns that I want to get started, so there's just never enough time in the week to get it all done, but or in the month. But a Descent campaign is something I've really wanted to check out, because I've had the Road to Legend expansion for a long time now, and I've just never been able to get people together to get the thing started. And so,
but you got to paint it first.
No. not painting the Descent. That's your ballpark there.
Yeah.
All right. So we've got another email here from Corey Girlman from Des Moines, Iowa. He says, "Hey guys, John was asking for how we transport store our miniature wargame components, so I thought I'd share what I do. For durable, less expensive minis like HeroScape, I use the craft storage boxes like the Plano boxes with dividers. I group each of them by faction and combine entire units together into each space. I especially like the ones with reconfigurable inserts to allow for different size unit groups." And that is pretty good for HeroScape. I use just like a Sterilite, like a plastic Sterilite box, because those things are pretty durable. The plastic gun is pretty durable, so you can kind of throw them all into one container, and that works pretty good. But I like dividing them up by faction and by units, too. He says, "For more delicate minis," and says he plays Rackham's Confrontation Age of Ragnarok, "I use a different method. I get a big roll of magnetic strip with adhesive on the back, then in a large Tupperware, or any old box, really. I like clear ones so I can see what's in each. Put several rows of magnet down, then I cut small pieces to stick to the bottom of each miniature. This works great for confrontation minis because the bases are concave, so the magnet I secure to its base actually levels out the piece perfectly, so it holds in place while sitting in the box, but doesn't affect how it stands on the table. Of course, if you're using metal bases, you can skip attaching magnets to them, and they should hold by themselves. Thanks for the great podcast. Keep up the good work."
Pretty cool.
I never even thought about doing it that way. You'd have to get some pretty strong magnets, I think, for if you were going to be transporting them any distance, I guess. But that's a really good suggestion. I actually got several emails with suggestions for storage and things like that, so I really do appreciate that. After thinking about it quite a bit and talking with my wife,
always a good first step.
I think I am going to go with a battle foam bag. And
oh, you're in, man.
Well, my friend David at work, he's even more in than I am as far as the products for War Machine. You know, he's gotten into this with me as well, and he purchased the War Machine bag. It's way more than I need right now as far as space, but it also at this point it could even hold my paints and all my hobbying stuff and tools and things like that, and it's just really well designed. It looks really, really slick, so I might be picking up that in the near future. But thanks so much for all of the suggestions on storage. So, Cody.
Our next email comes from Dan Zuccarelli, and he writes, "Hey guys, been listening to the cast for a while now, and I always enjoy it. I liked your segment about forming and maintaining a gaming group last week and hope to hear more. I have an interesting game group situation, though, that you may have some ideas to help me out. My friends have all expressed interest in getting together to play some games once or twice a month at my request, and while their interest is there, I'm the only one really in the scene at all, so I will pretty much be responsible for finding, bringing, teaching every new game that gets played."
In the scene. I like
in
that.
The scene.
I'm in the scene.
I certainly don't mind any of that, because I love playing and enjoying games with people, but the fact remains that I'm in a gaming group comprised of non-gamers. As an extra wrinkle, it's a few couples, so we usually have even numbers of players. I started off very slowly, Ticket to Ride, Wits and Wagers, apples to apples, so as not to scare anyone off with a meatier game, They've all been huge hits so far, but I want to branch out. We're all huge Battlestar Galactica fans of the show, so they wanted to play that game, but I've been kind of pushing it off since I figure it's more likely to confuse everyone since it can be pretty rules-heavy. I'd like to work up to it. Is there a good guideline to playing in a group like this? Luckily, the interest is there on their part, so how should I go about grooming them into good gamers? I figure down the line, once people know games for themselves, we can break into separate games, but for the time being, I'd like to be the ringmaster of the circus. Never done anything like this before, but I really want it to work and have, most importantly, for people to have fun. Any tips?
That's a tricky one.
Yeah. I think if they're all fans of BSG, if you kind of sit down and say, okay, this is meatier than anything we've played, I think it may go better than you think, because I've taught people BSG that I thought wouldn't really get it or wouldn't really like it, and they loved it. Because at its core, it's when you strip away all of like the kind of social aspect of it, it's a pretty straightforward game. You know, you do the same thing every turn, and there's a few wrinkles here and there, but I think it's easy, you know, once you get down to it. So
yeah. Well, and I think that the fact that everyone in your group likes Battlestar Galactica definitely helps with that, because it'll be very accessible. I would almost say, and you may not agree with me here, but I would maybe dial down the complexity just slightly and maybe try a game like Pandemic. I find that is a good, you know, it's more complex than Ticket to Ride or Wits and Wagers, but it's sort of a gateway into a game like Battlestar Galactica, and it's cooperative, which is, you know, the big buzzword these days, the cooperative games. So it might create some solidarity amongst all the people that you're working with, either that or, you know, gallows humor where you're losing every time, but you have that kind of solidarity that you could then move in and say, hey, we played Pandemic and it's got this sort of a feel to it. Now we're going to play a game that has a similar feel, but it takes it a step farther. Plus, hey, it's in the Battlestar Galactica world, which you guys already know because you like the show.
Yep.
So that might be something you could try.
Good idea.
There's a whole, you know, list, a litany of gateway games that, you know, and you know, we've been in a era of gaming where something like Ticket to Ride is considered to be, oh, the perfect gateway game. I almost feel now the IQ of gamers, or the gamer Q, if you will, has raised to the point where Ticket to Ride, I think, is not even really a gateway game in my mind anymore. It's almost more in the simpler category of games, and some other things might even take its place. What do you think about that?
I can see that. I still think it's a good gateway game, but I'm kind of waiting to see what the next step is. You know, for the longest time it was Settlers, and then it's Ticket to Ride, and I kind of wonder what the newest hotness would be.
I guess it depends on what gateway where you want this gateway to go, you know.
Yeah, I've heard things on that Pandemic is actually kind of getting to that spot. Just I've read different articles and blogs, and I know that the guys at Penny Arcade, the webcomic, they've kind of branched off and they play things like Shadows Over Camelot. Pandemic was a big one for them, so maybe that might be the new one, especially with the kind of the new age of cooperative games.
Yeah, oh, Shadows Over Camelot. I hadn't thought of that one. That's a good example too. That's even more themey, probably. So hopefully that will help a little bit. You know, just kind of keep nudging them in that direction and don't give up. And as long as you're able to get people together, I don't think you're going to scare people off too much. You know, don't pull out Twilight Imperium. But
no.
But you know, I just keep moving them in that direction. All right, we got one more email here in the inbox I wanted to read to you, and this is from our friend with the coolest name that we've ever heard, Magnus Lundgren.
Magnus.
Yep. And he says, hi, guys. On at least two, perhaps even three occasions in the last show, you touched on the subject of explaining rules.
Spoiler.
Have you done a show about that? If you haven't, that would make a good subject for the big deal, I think. It's a subject that I'm very interested in. I think we all have had both bad and good experiences around rules explanations. The never-ending one, the one where a crucial rule is left out, etc. Lots of material there. And he says, I wrote an article about what to think about when explaining rules on a Swedish board game forum and got positive feedback on it. So I translated it into English and put it on BoardGameGeek. And here's the link. So we'll put that link in the show notes as to where that is. He says, feel free to use it if you do a show on this subject. Regards, Magnus. Well, you know what?
We're done.
We're doing a show on that. So we read that email. We just got that in the last week, and we thought that was a great segue from what we had been talking about with event games. One of the biggest problems with event games is teaching of those rules, and so that's what we're going to talk about in our big deal. So your wish has come true, Magnus.
Well done.
And thanks so much for sending us that link.
All right. Well, we've got, as we kind of close out the emails, we have some contest news.
And contest
this,
news?
And this is big because, you know, we had to maybe take some time off, give the post office a rest after doing the big Tomathon, the vasectomy, as it were.
Yes, we've been told that our big winner, Patrick Ross, has received all of the shipments, so he now has that huge prize package of games in his possession now. So good for him.
Very good. So we have a new contest. It's obviously not as big a scale as that, but it gives you the opportunity to add a great game that may not be in your collection, and Johnny Boy is going to give you the details.
That's right. So as part of the great sponsor prize support that we got for the Tomathon, or the Tom Vassell fundraiser, we got a copy of Say Anything, the great party game from North Star Games. But what they actually sent us was an entire case of Say Anything, which is four games. And so we gave one copy to Patrick as part of the big prize package, but now we have three additional copies of Say Anything sitting around here, and we want to give them to you. And so we were trying to come up with a way of you know, what would be the best way to give away these games, and we thought about the game Say Anything and the concept behind that, and so it's given us an opportunity to unveil a new way to interact with Game On with Cody and John.
Uh-oh.
And that is our Game On voicemail box.
Oh, no.
That's right. We now have a dedicated phone number that you can call anytime and leave us a voicemail to say whatever you want to say, and maybe we'll play your voicemail on the show. And so for any kind of feedback or questions or whatever, you can always call the Game On voicemail box at 4138-GAME-ON.
Nice.
So that's 413-842-6366.
Put it in your phones right now.
And don't be thrown off by the area code, and I think it's a number in like Massachusetts. It's we did it through Google Voice, so it's don't worry about
it. I'm Boston callers, I feel right at home there.
Yeah, so it will definitely get to us. So yeah, 4138 Game On. And so here's what we want you to do to win a copy of Say Anything. Like I said, we've got three copies, so we're going to pick three winners in our next episode. And do you want this to go for two episodes or just one?
Let's do one. I want people to get on those phone lines.
That's right. The phone lines are the American Idol. The phone lines are open. So what we want you to do is to call us in at the Game On voicemail box.
That's 4138 Game On.
Thank you.
See, I can do that now.
Well done. And we want you to just tell us your name and where you're from, you know, city and state or province or country or whatever, and then answer this question for us. And the question is, and this is phrased sort of like a Say Anything question.
Right.
In your opinion, what game would you most like to see Cody and John cover in an upcoming episode of Game On?
That sounds good to me.
Yeah. And so what we're going to do is we're going to listen through all of these, and we're going to pick our three favorites. And because we still kind of go with the mantra of say what we want, play what we want.
Sure.
And so we want to pick the three games that we, you know, we think we would like to do as well. Whoever chooses those games will win a copy of Say Anything, three copies to give away. And then we promise that, as best we can, that we will review those games sometime in the next year or so. You know, we'll work those into the rotation, make sure that those three games get reviewed.
You know, I'm even going to call an audible on here.
Uh-oh.
Maybe let's expand that even to big deal topics.
Oh, okay.
Maybe if you've got a big deal topic and not a game necessarily, throw that out and we'll consider that as well.
Sure, that sounds good. So, yeah. So, in your opinion, what game or topic would you most like to see Cody and John cover in an upcoming episode of Game On? So, call us.
Do it.
Do it now. Get on the phones.
All right. Okay, Vinny. Yeah, get on the phones right away. Is this like the voice episode?
I don't know.
My goodness. We just have one little bit of gaming news before we go into one of my favorite segments. And that is there's apparently a new RPG from Fantasy Flight Games. Our good friends.
Oh, yes.
Death Watch, coming in August 2010.
Yeah, and this is part of that intellectual property thing where Fantasy Flight is releasing all this Warhammer stuff.
They're milking that cow, aren't they?
My goodness. And so this is another role-playing game in the Warhammer 40K universe called Death Watch, where you actually get to play Space Marines. And I think a lot of folks who like the 40K world, that's something that they've been looking for a long time, is the ability to actually play a big old Space Marine. So that's another one to check out. I'm still working through my Rogue Trader book. So, and you know, there's also the Dark Heresy role-playing game and the new book that's coming out for that called Ascension. And so there's lots of great role-playing stuff going on. I never thought of Fantasy Flight as a role-playing company, but they're really moving in that direction.
Whatever brings the dollars in.
I guess so, yeah.
Well, speaking of role-playing games, we have yet another segment of America's favorite topic.
Well, what topic is that?
Well, that would be the GM Academy.
Oh, okay. Well, let's roll it. Yes, indeed, it is another episode of the GM Academy, and I would like to present to you once again, for your listening pleasure and education, Professor Cody Jones.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, as always, to be here in the GM Academy. And I've gotten a few excellent emails, but this one really struck me, and this is from, I believe it is Colbert Rahal, and maybe Colbert, like Stephen Colbert.
That would be awesome if it was Colbert Rahal.
But he writes, I'm expiring GM.
You're an expiring GM.
I'm sorry. Back to the academy. Back to the academy.
It's back to the academy.
I am an aspiring GM.
That's much better.
That is torn on which RPG to delve into as a commitment. I have 2 years' experience in a second edition AD&D campaign. That's what I learned on. And have a broad understanding of game mechanics. I went the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay third edition route.
Good man.
And found that it didn't work for me. Too many components to track.
Oh.
What I'm looking for is a solid game system with lots of adventures. I just don't got time to be creating them these days. Western accent added by myself. And something accessible for my players. I have good friends new to the gaming hobby, and they're willing to try anything I put in front of them. But if it's too busy, like Warhammer Fantasy Roleplaying, it will turn them off. Is Dark Heresy a good choice, or is the Warhammer 40K universe too intimidating to new players? Traveler, maybe, though I notice not many adventures. I'd like adventures that have good flavor text, especially describing the scene to players. I really have a tough time improvising with the setting, but I am great on taking on NPCs. I thought possibly about D&D 4th edition, but I feel uncomfortable with a system that has 2 DM books and 2 players' handbooks. Too much. Looking forward to your response, and sorry about the wall of text. I didn't know where else to turn.
Oh, he's at his final rope.
What?
Final rope? His...
He has no more rope to give. That's his final rope. I'm here to help him.
I need to just back up. Yeah. Go ahead.
This is the academy,
yes,
sir.
Yes. Sorry, professor.
Thank you. Your last topic actually hit perfectly with the, you had thought about D&D 4th edition. I say that's where you go. Now, you said the 2 players' handbooks and the 2 DMGs kind of turned you off. And probably by the time you listen to this, there will be 3 players' handbooks out, because I believe Players' Handbook 3 is coming out very shortly.
The search for more money.
That's right. But all you need for 4th edition is, since you're an experienced player, I would say go ahead and get this, the core rule set, which is Players' Handbook DMG Monster Manual. I think that will fit your group perfectly, because it doesn't have very many fiddly bits, like actual, you know, components that you move around. And it has that D&D feel, and you'll be able to jump right in, and I think you'll really be able to jump in and enjoy playing it much more quickly than any of the other ones you listed.
Does it have that D&D feel because it is D&D?
Yes.
Okay. Just was wondering
that. This is the academy, sir.
I apologize. I'll step back, sir.
Jeez. You will be demoted. And as far as adventures and other things you may want to run, I would even also suggest you can pick up either, they have the introductory adventure, which is called Keep on the Shadowfell, which I believe you can still download free from their website. They may be changing that, I'm not sure.
Search for more money.
That's right. You may even also want to try 1 month of the D&D Insider subscription, because they have so many adventures, especially for low-level characters, that you can get into. You won't have to do a bit of prep work. They even do the flavor text for you. And they make NPCs to where you can kind of inject your personality, since you said you were good at that. You can really kind of inject that in there. So my suggestion is actually D&D 4th edition. If you just get that core rule book, then I think you'll be good to go. And, heck, you may even only need the player's handbook and get... And if you get some of the D&D Insider tools, they'll have the monster stats there for you. But I'd say get that core set, and I think you'll be good to go. Let us know how it goes.
Awesome.
Done.
Well, Professor Cody, thank you once again for your wisdom and insight here in the GM Academy.
I do what I can.
If you have any questions for Cody in the GM Academy, or any other questions or comments for us here at Game On with Cody and John, please write us, please, at the Game On Inbox at...
GameOnInbox@gmail.com.
Or you can call us on the Game On voicemail box.
at 4138 game on.
That's 4138426366.
Yeah, good job, buddy.
It's the first time.
Come numbers on, are hard.
Cut me some freaking slack. All right, well, that just about wraps up the Game On Inbox. Time to move on to the big deal where we're going to be talking about teaching rules.
The big deal.
As far as deals go, this one's pretty big.
Well, welcome to the big deal, where today we're going to be talking about teaching rules to games. And this is a part of gaming that I don't think gets covered too often, because we like to talk about playing games. But that initial part where you've got to sit down with a rule book, pull out all the components, and actually learn the rules to a game can be one of the most important parts, because if you don't know the rules, then how are you going to teach them to others? And if you can't teach them to others, then how are they going to play?
And you can be totally turned off if you get a really bad rules explanation. You may not want to even go into it again.
That is true. And that's maybe the first point I want to talk about, is the importance of this, of rules explaining, and why it's a good idea to gain at least a little bit of skill in this. And I'm not claiming to have any skill in this whatsoever. I may be the rules explanation guy on Game On with Cody and John, but I really think I have a long way to go and a lot to learn from other people, and especially you listeners, about how you go about teaching games. But it is extremely important, because I've had several situations, I think a couple with you, Cody, where I have not done a real good job of teaching the rules, and I think it's ended up really turning you off a little bit from the game. Not completely, but I think it's a real good way in a gaming group to bore the hell out of people.
Yes.
And so I think there's a few steps that you can take, I think, that will make teaching rules fun for you, fun for the people that you're teaching, and a more enjoyable experience overall. Because Cody said before that the learning game is already going to be a slog.
Yeah, right? It sucks.
Yeah, it's not going to be that much fun anyway. So you want to maximize the fun as much as you can in those kind of situations. So the first thing that I would suggest with teaching rules is to know the rules yourself. This seems like a no-brainer, but this is the part for me that's actually the hardest, because I'm not very good at reading comprehension. I'm just not. And so sitting down with a big rule book and just reading it and trying to learn it is very difficult for me. So what I typically have to do is, when I get a new game, I pull all the stuff out, I unpunch all of the chits and cardboard pieces, and put stickers on things if you need to do that or whatever. And then I just set up the game, and I start at the very beginning of the rule book with the setup, and then I just set it up. And this process, I take as much time as possible. So even for a game that might only take an hour to play, I might take 2 hours of my own, 2 to 3 hours of my own time to sit down and work through the setup, and I want to make sure that I understand each component as I'm setting it up. And once I get the game set up and, using the setup instructions, and a lot of rule books these days are really good at this. Fantasy Flight especially has really good setup sections to their rule books. And, you can just set the game up, and then I kind of just work through a turn. For a game that is, two or more players, I'll just set up a play area for at least, two players. If I know that I'm going to be teaching like a 4-player game, like when we played Middle Earth Quest, I knew that was going to be a 4-player game. So I actually set up 4 areas around a table, and I probably looked like an idiot while I was doing this, and then I just played through each turn, as each person. I actually went and sat at the different parts of the table and played through the turns.
And you actually got up and moved, huh?
Well, yeah, because I couldn't fit all the stuff around me in one area. That was the only reason why I did it.
You
should
do voices.
I will move my...
I move Elrond over here.
The hobbits will move here. And it's just a meticulous reading through the rules, And I think that for some people, this isn't their forte, and it's just not going to be very much fun. I know that, Cody, talk to me a little bit about your experience with rules as far as like big games and everything, because you don't have to teach too often, because I do the teaching the majority of the time.
Yeah, I have you on retainer for that. I've had certain instances where Someone will say, someone that's maybe played a game a few times, say, hey, let's play X. And we all sit down, and the person gets ready to teach us, and they pull out the rule book, and they start with page one. And they're like,
and they read it to you.
Page one, this is a game about, and they just, and you try to interrupt, but it doesn't work, you know?
Right.
I've had experiences where, I don't know, I just don't like a lot up front, because I feel like I'll forget half of it. I'm kind of a, what do I need to know now? And then kind of, I like this, the slow feeding of information. You mm-hmm. know, I pretty much like, I want to know the base goal of the game, what I can do in a turn, and then as we get to more complicated elements, we'll get there. Because I'm of the, some people will say, well, you have to have all that information up front, you know, to have a fair game. I think in a learning game, it's like an exhibition game. I'm like, you don't really play that to win, you know?
Right.
You're playing to get the game learned so that the next time you can play an actual game where you're trying to win.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's kind of like if you're teaching BSG, for example, you may not mention the sleeper phase, which we call halftime.
Yeah.
You know, you may not mention that till it comes up because it's kind of like an ooh moment,
mm-hmm.
you know, and some people may say, well, if you don't know about that's coming, you know, that may screw your strategy up. It's like, well, yeah.
I think that's something you always have to deal with is the fact that no matter how well you know the rules and how well you teach them, there's going to be that moment where you've forgotten something.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then if you bring that up, you're going to have either people that are cool, especially good friends, will be like, oh, no problem. Or you're going to have that one jerk who says, oh, well, I would have done things completely different if
I hate know. That guy. Yeah.
I pretty much hate that guy too.
Yep.
And so I think preparation is important. And so that's why, I mean, going through, it seems like maybe a little overkill going to the trouble of setting up a game and almost playing through a fake game by myself. But it's mainly just so that when I get to the point of teaching the rules, I don't have to start off with, this game is about, and I'm reading through the rule book, because I just sort of know it in my head. A good example just from recently is when I taught Rune Wars. I actually didn't have as much time to prepare as I wanted to, but it still ended up going okay because I was able to play through a little bit of a game turn, and I didn't have to start off with saying, all right, so set up part one. You guys each get two quest cards. I mean, what does that deck look like? Let me go get those out. You know, I at least knew the setup pretty cold to where, you know, that could go pretty quickly. And I think when you have a real big game, it's like you said, it's important to not give too much information because you are going to overload people. I like to think of it after I've learned everything. I like to think of it in terms of this: what is the point of the game? And my joke is every time I start teaching rules to a game, I say, the point of this game is to win, and here's how you win.
To win, you need the most points.
To win, you need the most points. And I start from the end there with the goal in mind of, you know, you need to get the most points. Well, how do you get points in this game? And then you can sort of back up from there and say, you know, a good example would be, let's take Ticket to Ride. That's a game that many people are familiar with. You know, the point of Ticket to Ride is to get the most points. The way that you get points is by completing your routes on the destination tickets. And at the beginning of the game, you're going to get this number of tickets. And so at the bottom of the card, it'll show the number of points that you'll get if you're able to complete this route. Well, then that brings up the question, well, how do you complete a route? Well, then you can back up from there and you can say, well, here's how you complete routes is by connecting these cities. How do you connect the cities together? And then you can basically back into the main point of a game turn, which is you use these cards to get routes, and here's how you get cards, and this is how your turn works. And you know, just by starting with the end in mind, I think people really can put things together in their head a lot better if they know the goal at the very beginning. Because if you just start from the beginning and just say, you take these two cards and you're going to, you know, you go through all the mechanics of getting the cards and you can have as many in your hand as you want. And people are sitting there going, what do I use these cards for? You know, yeah. But if they already know ahead of time what the goal of the game is, then that can really help.
It's kind of funny because people, especially in the board game geek community, they'll turn their nose up at older games, you know, your Monopoly, your Clue, whatever. But if you look at those old rule books, after like the list of components, the goal is the very next thing usually put on the sheet. You know, it'll say goal to be the last player with money left in the game. The goal to find the
object,
murder.
Right?
Yeah. Object, yeah. And you know, there's a lot to learn from that because it's like you have the components which you lay out, and then you say the goal, and like you said, move backward. And I think that's a good way, at least for me, because I can start kind of reasoning things out from there. You know, I'll start, you know, I may be wrong, but I'm like, oh, I bet that's used for X, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's a good way to get people engaged in the game, and they're already thinking strategy, whether they intend to or not, once they hear that goal.
Yep. The game that I think is one of the easiest to teach is Dominion, and what's one of the reasons why I like it so much, is because any new player, you can immediately start them out and say, the point of the game is to win. The way that you win is by getting these green victory point cards. You point to those, you know. And then how do you get those green victory point cards? Well, you have to buy them, and they cost this amount. And you're going to start off with this amount of money, and then you're going to use these cards in the middle to allow you to get more money so that you can buy more of those cards toward the end. I mean, I didn't even mention the word deck building anywhere in that explanation, but that's enough to get people's minds churning of this is what my main goal is. And then as you start adding on more of those mechanics, they can start to absorb them. But I think giving your players a framework for what the purpose of the game is, it's good. It's sort of like handing them a bucket before you fill it up with water.
Yeah.
You know, and if they don't have a bucket and you're pouring water on them, then all they're going to do is get wet and not really have anything to hold on to.
Yeah, and Dominion's one of those really fun ones where it has a learning curve that is unteachable, you know, because you teach them how to play. And then I think everyone that's played Dominion has gone through this about halfway through your first game. You're like, oh, crap.
The aha moment, yeah.
Oh, that's how I play.
Right.
Oh, I see. And, you know, you lose horribly your first game, you know.
Right.
But I really like the games that have that next level of aha to them, you know, where you can't possibly teach the finer kind of strategy mechanic. That's just something you really have to kind of learn on your own. But
right.
That's a nice side effect, especially when you see it, when their kind of eyes light up like, oh.
Yeah. Games like that are a lot of fun because you can see that they're not going to get it until they have that moment for themselves. So you teach them as best you can, and they have a confused look on their face, and it's almost kind of exciting thing. You're like, oh, I can't wait till they get to that point because yep. I know they're going to get it. So anyway, I think that's creating a framework for your players of knowing what the purpose of the game is a good thing. I think what you just mentioned, Cody, earlier was about not loading down people with too many rules up front, not front loading the rules. And I will admit, this is probably my biggest shortcoming when it comes to teaching rules, is that I do tend to sometimes spit out a little bit too much because, you know, I'll start to think that particular nuances of the game rules are more important than they actually are. And I think that the reason why I think that is because I've been burned so many times by people later on in the game going, oh, you didn't tell me that, you know. So I'm like, well, I want to make sure I mention this and this and this so that they don't do that to me. But I think it's important to start them down the path and then just teach things as they go.
Yeah, another thing that, and this is actually a pair of things I think go well together, is you should take the first turn, you know, even if there's some going first element. I think, you know, if you're the most experienced, go ahead and go first. And then the thing that goes along with that, and probably the more important thing, is that talk through your turns, at least early on. Not only yours, but theirs. I mean, it may seem kind of silly for the first couple turns, but, you know, in Ticket to Ride, you're like, well, I could do this, this, or this. I'll choose to take cards. You know, it'd probably be better for more complex games. But talk through your actions. Don't just kind of shut down and go into you know, Lloyd and I's Dominion mode, where we don't say anything. We're like, chapel, you know.
Right.
You know, but talk through everything you're doing and kind of make sure everyone's on board. That way, when it's their turn, they may find it easier if they talk through their turn, or they at least know what you did and why you did it and how you did it within the rules.
Right, right. I think that knowing what you can do on your turn is very, of course, very important. And some games, you know, like Ticket to Ride, you only have three choices of what you can do on your turn. But for some other games, you have a lot more choices than that. And I think that's where players' guides and players' mats and reference sheets become very important. And these are things that, fortunately, with Board Game Geek being around, and especially one particular user named Universal Head.
Love it.
he has put together so many of these reference sheets for different games that you can print out and, you know, give them to each player. Some games you're fortunate enough to actually have those available to you. One that particularly comes to mind is Fury of Dracula. They have like a turn order card. A lot of other games, a lot of Days of Wonder games, I think, have turn order cards of what you can do in your game turn. But, you know, maybe consider researching some of those and printing those out ahead of time. And those are only useful, I think, if you know how to teach those, too. If you just hand someone a reference card and just say, here, there's a reference card.
Yep. Yeah.
But maybe go through that step by step a little bit. But I think that, you know, the next thing is to make sure to make sure that all your players are on the same page with regard to something being a learning game. It's just a natural side effect. You're not going to have the richest game experience on your first turn. And if everybody knows that up front, then I think that you can sort of manage expectations a little bit.
Yep. And if you have that guy that says, well, if I would have known that, don't invite him next time.
Yeah.
Because he's a pox on the gaming society.
Exactly. You know, I actually had a situation like that arise at a tournament that I was running for HeroScape several years ago, where it was a 6-player game. I had built a gigantic map with, like, I want to say 3 or 4 different sets. The thing was like 2.5 feet tall. It looked like a big volcano. Nope. And I designed it as a 6-player game, and I put the whole draft together. And, you know, it was one of my, I think, more shining moments as a game explainer. But there was this one particular rule that I must have just missed or something. Well, actually, I don't think that I missed it. I think that this particular person just hadn't heard me explain it. And then got to this point where they were being attacked or, you know, screwed over in some way. And I said, well, you can do this. And that player said, oh, no, you said I couldn't do that. No, you can do that. And we got into this big argument to where he, you know, he thought, well, why should I even play this? Because you totally screwed me because you didn't teach me this rule. And then he ended up winning the whole game.
Yeah.
And there was even a prize involved where the you know, they got a pretty decent prize. And, mm-hmm. and that was just, you know, really, it made me not want to ever do a game like that again. And I never have done something that extensive. So, if you're not teaching the game, let's go into that. Don't be a jerk.
Yeah.
You know, be patient with the person who's teaching the rules, even if it is that person who has opened the rule book and started on page 1. I mean, you know, give them a little bit of grace and realize that it's not that easy to teach some of these hobby style board games.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a question.
Okay.
I tend to be the person who teaches the rules in our group. But my question is, do you, Cody, feel like like this is something that's just sort of an inherent thing that someone has as a skill, that or is it something that you should try to rotate around the group, or you know, what do you think as far as rules explaining goes? Because I'll tell you that when we went and played Twilight Imperium a few weeks ago, and your friend Josh taught that game, that was great for me because mm-hmm. every time we pull out a new game, I'm always the person who's explaining the rules, and I like it. It's, you know, but it was really nice to get a break from it mm-hmm. and have someone else teach me the rules. So, you know, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, if you've got someone in your group that's really good at it and they don't mind doing it, then I don't think you necessarily have to rotate around. I mean, it's good to give them a break, sure.
Yeah.
But I think some of it's a learned skill, but I think some of it's just inherent in their personality. Some people are just better at teaching and better at giving presentations and better at explaining than others are. So if they're up for it, then let them do it by all means.
Yeah. So if you think that you're that kind of a person who is likes to teach and likes to demonstrate things and that kind of stuff, then, you know, definitely encourage you as you're doing your gaming to, you know, volunteer to be that person to teach the rules. And, you know, I really think prep work up front, if I could give any piece of advice, knowing the game as well as you possibly can ahead of time. And for something that you own or you've owned for a long time, it might just involve pulling the rule book out and just flipping through a couple of rules, you know, so that you can refresh your memory. But, you know, Cody and I play so many new games that are new to both of us that it sometimes takes a lot of extra effort just to sit down and make sure that you know something ahead of time. It'll make the experience better for everyone.
Yep. And I guess if I had one point of advice, it would be don't front load your game explanations. You know, there can be a lot done by a sample turn or just by doing, you know, the first turn as a group or however you would do it. So don't be afraid to go in the pool a little earlier than you might normally do.
Yep. One last thing, another resource that I think is a good thing for that is available these days is video reviews. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll go ahead and toot Tom Vassell's horn again. One thing that he's done, I think, more extensively than just about anyone in the board gaming hobby right now is video reviews of games. And, you know, he doesn't go into huge amounts of detail, but most of his reviews are about 10 minutes long, and he shows all the components and really does kind of give some basic overviews of the game. If you are about to play a game, maybe this weekend you're going to get some buddies together to play Rune Wars. Actually, I don't think he's reviewed that one. But, let's say you were going to get together to play Thunderstone. Right, Cody?
Why?
Because it's a good game. Okay. And you wanted to get your friends a bit of a primer, if you will, on how to how's that drink over there?
No, very good. Sorry about that.
And you wanted to give your friends a bit of a primer on the game, then you could give them a link to Tom's review of Thunderstone, where he goes over some of the basic rules of it, and you know, any information that people can get up front is probably a good thing.
Even for more in depth reviews, he hasn't done one in a while, but Board Games with Scott.
Oh yeah,
yeah. He does a lot. He does a little more on the teaching side of it as well.
That's right. It's kind of his profession. Yeah.
Yep. So either one would be a good resource, and it kind of gives you a break. We did that for Diplomacy.
Oh yeah, that's right.
That Eddie Bresson had posted like a 4-part introduction to Diplomacy. I mean, the video quality was kind of bad, but he did it much better than I could have ever done it.
Yeah.
So we just all watched that, and then we answered questions on the finer points. So
yeah,
I mean, good point on the vidges.
On the vidges, yeah. So as always with all of our big deal topics, we want to hear from you, and we know that there's a lot of great game explainers out there. Of course, we heard from Magnus Lundgren, who gave us that link to his ways about teaching games. But we would love to hear from you about some tips and tricks that you have for teaching rules, maybe good or bad experiences that you've had, any funny anecdotes or whatever. And so we'd invite you to write us at the Game On Inbox.
At gameoninbox@gmail.com.
And tell us all about it. And we love reading your emails on the show, and we just love to hear your experiences with teaching rules.
And listening to phone calls.
Oh, that's right. You can also check out the new Game On voicemail box at
4138 Game On.
That's right. So that just about wraps up our big deal. Let's move into our Buy Try It or Not. We're going to be talking about Tobago.
Buy, Try, or Deny.
Game reviews for the common gamer.
It's that simple.
My sweet island Tobago, I love you. Land of steel pan and calypso, man, I love you.
All right, well, we just got done talking about teaching rules, and here at Buy, Try, or Deny, or I guess it should be Buy, Try, and Deny.
No, let's just stick with
Buy,
got.
Try, or
Buy,
deny.
Try, or Deny.
Tradition.
Version 2.0.
That's right. John is going to break down the rules for the new hotness, Tobago.
Is this the new hotness?
I don't know. New to me.
It's pretty cool.
New to you.
The new coolness. So Tobago is from Rio Grande Games.
Grand.
Yeah. It's designed by Bruce Allen. It's for 2 to 4 players and plays in about, I'd say about an hour. It's a good. Would you say that's probably a good estimate? About an hour?
Yeah. Give or take.
Okay. And so this game is about treasure hunting, more or less. It's the island of Tobago, which is a Caribbean island, and in the game board itself, you're actually going to sort of assemble in 3 parts and make this island. And there's 3, I guess they're like triangular pieces that fold out, and they make this very oddly shaped map. And so the 3 pieces fit together, and then there's almost like these puzzle pieces on the outside that lock it in place. So the design of the board is very, very cool. It's not shaped like any game board that I've ever seen. And the pieces are double-sided, so there's a lot of configurability where it can be different each time. And so on the board itself, there's going to be a whole series of hexagons. And you know what, Cody? I just realized that as I'm teaching these rules, I am not following my own instructions from the big deal.
Tisk,
which is
tisk.
Which is to start with the goal of the game in mind and then move backwards from that. So my apologies, listeners. So we're going to start with what is the purpose of Tobago?
To win.
Purpose of the game is to win. And the way that you win is by having the most treasure.
Points.
Treasure points, yeah. And this is a treasure hunting game. There's all these treasure cards that have a particular number of coins on them that you're going to be collecting through the course of the game. And then whoever has the most of those at the end of the game is going to be the winner. How do you get those treasure cards?
How do you get those treasure cards?
I'm glad you asked that. You're going to get these treasure cards by finding the buried treasure that's on the island. And the way that you find that treasure, quote unquote, is by contributing to sort of the treasure hunting process. And this is where the mechanic of the game is unlike really anything that I've seen. Like I said, you're going to have this board that's like an island, and you'll have the different hexes. There are 6 different kinds of terrain on the island. There's beach, jungle, river, scrubland, lake, and mountain. And much like Settlers of Catan, it's real easy to tell by looking at the hexes what's what. They're very there's a lot of differentiation between those different kinds of terrain. in addition to the terrain, you're also going to have some of these little wooden huts. There's four wooden huts. There's three palm trees, and these are like three-dimensional wooden green palm trees. And then these three statues, which kind of look like shortened versions of like the Easter Island statues, and they're going to go on the board as well. So you're going to set up all this stuff and spread these things all around, and then you're going to get, as your piece, a little wooden all-terrain vehicle, a little ATV, where you're going to be just off-roading on this island to look for all this treasure. Like I said, the treasure is represented by treasure cards, and so you're going to have a stack of those. When you set the game up, there are two cards called curse treasures, and you're going to shuffle those into the lower, out of the 39 cards, you're going to shuffle them into the lower 27 of the cards, and then you're going to put those on the board. Then you're also going to have these things called clue cards, and the playing of the clue cards is really where the treasure hunting part of the game occurs. And so when your turn starts, you're going to put your ATV wherever you want to on the board, wherever you want to. And you can actually drive through any of these terrains on your ATV. So even if you're in like a lake, you can still drive through the lake in your ATV. And you're going to get a certain number of clue cards to start off with. And like the three-player game that we played with Cody's wife, Kaylin, you draw four cards. So you have four of these clue cards. So on your turn, you're going to be doing one of a couple of things. One, you can actually play a clue card, or you can move your ATV around. So the way the clue cards work is like this. There are four treasures in the game, and they are represented by four different colors of wooden cubes. No Euro-style game is complete without a little bit of wooden cube action.
Yay.
Okay, I knew Cody would like that. And so each of those cubes, the cubes themselves don't represent the treasure, but they represent possible areas where the treasure could be on the board. And this is where like the deduction element starts off. At the very beginning of the game, you're going to start off with a clue card underneath each of these piles of treasure. They kind of go next to the board. And the way the clue cards work is they're going to tell you where the treasure is located. And it's going to be just a particular element of where the treasure is located. And there's symbols that represent different things on these cards. You might see a hex that says a river, and so if it's just a hex with a river on it, then you play that clue card. That means that particular treasure is in a river hex. And so, but there's many river hexes on the board, so it narrows down the board to just the river hexes. So then on a future turn, someone might play a card underneath that says that, it's in the river hex, and then maybe it's next to a statue. And so there's a icon on the card that'll show that something is next to a particular kind of terrain or a particular thing like a statue or a hut. So now you can narrow it down again. Now you're only going to be looking at the hexes that are in a river area and next to a statue. Now, as you're doing this, you're just narrowing down and making the area where the treasure could be smaller and smaller. You're going to use the cubes to represent where the treasure could possibly be. So when you play that first one that says that it's on a river hex, you're going to take that color of cubes and put them in all of the river hexes, one per hex. So you can just sort of see that's the possibilities for where that treasure could be. Then when you play the next card, let's say it's next to a statue, now you're going to remove all the cubes from the board except for the ones that will meet those criteria, be in a river hex and next to a statue. And eventually, as you play more cards, you're going to narrow it down to just one hex where that treasure could possibly be. And once you've done that, then any of the players can use on their turn their ATV move to move to where that hex is and claim the treasure. So that's the basics of the game as far as what you're trying to do. You're trying to, and there's four treasures that you're working on at any one time, so there could be multiple things that you're going after here. So you're trying to play clue cards to narrow down where these treasures are. And that's a rule, too, that you can't play a clue card that doesn't narrow down the number of hexes where the treasure might be. So you couldn't play a card that says that it's in a river hex and then play another card that says it's not in a river hex, which would eliminate it to zero so forth and so on. So once the treasure is claimed, once someone moves their ATV onto where that treasure is, then you're going to divide up the treasure. The one thing I forgot to mention is that when you play a clue card, you're going to have a little token, a little compass rose token with your player's color on it, and you're going to place that on the clue card. So you're going to sort of get credit for having put these clues onto the different treasures. And so you might have a row of four or five clue cards once a treasure is claimed. When the treasure is claimed, the player that has claimed that treasure will put a compass rose at the bottom of all those cards. So they're going to get credit as well for having claimed that treasure. Then you're going to distribute the treasure. This is another interesting mechanic. Each player is going to take a number of cards based upon the number of compass roses that are in that line of clue cards. So for every card that you contributed to the clues, you're going to get a treasure card. But these aren't yours to keep necessarily. You're going to look at them. So you get an idea of maybe one or two or three of the cards of what treasure amounts are going to be on those cards. Then you're going to hand those back to the person who is claiming the treasure. And they're going to gather all of those cards up. You're going to add one more card from the deck onto this pile and then shuffle them up face down. So you're only starting off by seeing just a couple of these cards. And so then you're going to take and turn over the first of these treasure cards. And you're going to start at the bottom of the row of treasure cards. So the very thing at the bottom is the compass rose that was placed by the person who claimed the treasure. So they get first pick of this treasure card. So you turn it over and then you offer it to that person. And they decide whether they want it or not. If not, then it moves up one space to the next to that bottom clue card. And whoever's compass rose is on that, then they get to decide whether they want it or not. If you decide that you do want a treasure, then you take that card, you put it face down in your treasure pile, and then you'll take your compass rose off of that treasure card, or that clue card, to indicate that you've claimed it for that. So you get that number of claims based upon how many cards that you put out. Then the next card is drawn, and you start at the bottom again, and you move upwards. So as you can see, the people who place the earlier clues are going to get less of a chance, or they'll get the last pick of the treasure. So it's a good idea to, one, to be the person to claim the treasure because you're going to get the first pick of the best treasure, or to be one of the people that places one of the last cards that's going to give you a better chance at getting better treasure. So once all of the treasure has been handed out, and you're never under an obligation to take a treasure card, but once all the treasure cards are gone, if there's any compass roses still left in the pile, then they get discarded and you don't get any treasure for that. But once all the treasure has been distributed, then you're going to start with the player who claimed the treasure, and that player will play a new clue card to kind of start over that treasure again. They sort of recycle as things go on. So if it was the gray treasure, then you'll play another card that will start over another treasure hunt for the gray treasure. So there's some specific rules about how your ATV can move around. It's pretty simple, and you can move pretty quickly. But that's going to be the main thing that you're trying to do, is you're trying to play clue cards on the treasure. You're trying to claim that treasure with your ATV, and then you have that sort of distribution element where there's some strategy in trying to select the best treasures. Now, the other thing, the one last part of this game that adds a little bit of flavor and perhaps complication to it, are these things called amulet tokens. So the amulet tokens are these hexagonal things that have a little gold face on them. And at the very beginning of the game, none of these are on the board. After a treasure is claimed, then you're going to place three amulets onto the board. And what you're going to do is look at the three statue tokens that are on there. And they have faces on them. And so whatever direction they're facing, they have to have a specific facing direction, you're going to kind of draw a straight line straight across where the statue would be looking, basically, and in a line all the way to the shoreline, the very edge of the island, and then you're going to place an amulet there. So you'll do that for all three of them, and then you're going to take your statues and rotate each one of them 60 degrees clockwise, so that the next time you claim a treasure, then more amulets are going to be placed, but they'll be placed in three different locations. So these amulets are, you can pick them up on your turn when you move your ATV, and there are some specific powers that they will do that will help you out during the game. So you can use an amulet anytime during your turn, and you can use as many of them as you want on your turn. These are the things that your amulets can do. One will allow you to, if you use one, you can use it to play a clue card. So maybe you've already played a clue card, but you can actually play an amulet in order to play another one. Or maybe you've done an ATV move that turn. You can use an amulet to be able to play a clue card. You can use it to take an extra move with your ATV. You can use it to remove a sight marker. So let's say that you had narrowed down a particular treasure to where it only had two cubes left. You could use an amulet to remove one of those cubes of your choice, which would then narrow it down to the one final location of that treasure. So that might be a strategic thing you'd want to do. The other thing you can do is you can exchange clue cards. A player can discard all of the clue cards from their hand and then redraw the same from the clue card deck. You're always going to have four in your hand. If you play one, you're going to draw back up at the end of your turn. But if you don't like your hand, you can use an amulet to kind of redraw your hand. And then the last thing that you can do with your amulet is that you can protect yourself against a curse. I mentioned that in the treasure deck, there's two cursed treasures. And those cursed treasures, if they come up during a treasure distribution, then basically the treasure distribution is over. And anybody who still has a compass rose doesn't get any treasure. And everybody who was involved in it, in this particular treasure distribution, has to give up their highest treasure card. But if you have an amulet, then you can give up the amulet instead, and you don't have to lose that high treasure card. So those are the things the amulets can do, and those are going to be all around the board, and people are going to be picking those up as well. So that adds a little extra flavor to the game. The game is going to end after the treasure card deck runs out and when that last treasure distribution happens. And then everyone's going to add up their points to see how many gold coins they have on their cards. Whoever has the most points is the winner. So that is Tobago. So as we mentioned in our last episode, we have kind of a new way that we're doing our buy, try, or deny reviews. In the past, we've just sort of given an overview of the game, like I just did, and then we just sort of talked about it and then gave a rating of buy, try, or deny. But we've moved on to, we've refined ourselves a bit.
2.0, as you mentioned.
Yes, buy, try, or deny 2.0, where we're instead going to kind of divide the game up into what we call buy points, try points, and deny points. And, you know, the good things, the okay things, and the not so good things. And then from that, hopefully you can get an idea as to whether you might want to purchase this game or check it out, because who cares about our opinions?
That's right.
So, Cody, why don't we start off and tell us what you thought the buy points were for Tobago?
Well, I definitely thought it was a unique game experience. It was similar to the feeling I had after the first game of Dominion I played. I'm like, wow, I have never really played a game like this. This is kind of new. This is fresh. So it's definitely not a... not kind of a retread of something else. I think you'll really find that it's unique and it's an enjoyable game. It's definitely kind of on its own, at least Jones theory right now.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah. I see what you're saying.
Yeah, it's not quite as
it is Jones theory compliant.
Yeah, it's even if it were terrible, it'd be Jones theory compliant. It's not quite as deduction like Clue or what Mystery Express sounds like it'll be like, you know, from what I've seen. So it's definitely its own thing. It's like almost strategy mixed with deduction, because you get to make your own deduction, but very unique game, and I think you'll like it. And then the random placement, the double-sided tiles, things like that really give it a lot of shelf life. You could even say that no two games will be the same, and I think that's important, especially with game prices going up, and I hate to say it, but in this economy, you know.
Herbert Hoover.
Yeah. I think the unique experience plus the freshness that each game can have gives this game a lot of buy potential. So well, what do you think buy point-wise?
All right, well, I think my first point is that I think the components on this game are fantastic. I think that the artwork and the color on the board is very vibrant. It feels very Caribbean without feeling like, you know, Tiki Torch Caribbean.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's got that sort of exotic feel to it. You know, good wooden quality components. The cubes are, you know, cubes. And the little statues and the... huts and the palm trees, those are really well done, and having those three-dimensional pieces on the board really give it kind of some cool flavor. Also, the ATVs are an interesting shape. They even went to the trouble of painting on like a front grill and a little windshield and headlights.
That was a nice touch. So yeah, that cost him a little more.
Yeah. So the components of the game are very good, so you're going to get a lot for your money there. I do like the fact that it's what I would call a deduction game with a greater element of control. So, I mean, it's not really deduction so much as like Clue, where there's an absolute answer and you're just trying to deduce. It's like you participate in that deduction and you have control of where things are going to be going and where things are. And that strategic element, I think it's like Cody says, it's unique. I've never really seen anything that does it quite like that. And I think that makes it quite a lot of fun. I also think that the treasure distribution mechanic is clever, because it does add some strategy there, where, you know, you do seem to be rewarded for getting the treasure and also for, you know, being one of the last people to play clue cards under the treasure. So, right. You know, and the fact you get to peek at a couple of treasure cards before you hand them in, I just thought that was really interesting. So it almost feels a little bit like a game of blackjack or something like that when you're distributing the treasure and the card gets turned over and you have to decide, you know, do you want to play or fold, basically? Do you want to claim it or do you want to pass and hopefully get a better card the next time? So I thought that was really good, too. So those are my buy points. What were your try points, sir?
Mainly the style of deduction mechanic. It won't be for the same crowd where you're really trying to figure it out. You know, we keep mentioning Clue, but it's not that kind of deduction because there is that little bit of luck to it. And, you know, with the playing of cards, you know, it doesn't reward a really thorough kind of thought process with deduction, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, which I think not a bad thing for me.
Yeah, I feel like I'm probably going to get slammed on this because maybe deduction is not really even the right word for this game, mm-hmm. but you know, hopefully you listeners know what I mean here.
Yeah, but you know, it. Some people may really like that, and I'm fine with it either way, honestly. The other thing being that to me, this game is very much like. It's like a Euro game in disguise, because I think when you play it, I get that Euro game feeling, not the real bad Euro game feeling, you know, but I'm like
a nauseous feeling.
Oh, jeez. But it feels like a Euro game with an Ameritrash hat on it, because it's got like the real colorful things. It's got 3D pieces, and then you get down to it, and there's all these kind of like levels of doing things and certain strategies. I'm like, oh, it's a Euro game.
You tricked me.
Yeah, but that's a try point because I think it scratches. Both itches fairly well, probably a little more on the Euro side, but just be aware of that. I say it like it's a warning. Right. Like, guys, hey, watch out.
Careful.
You know, don't give candy this Euro game.
All right, well, my try points were mainly revolving around the mechanic of the amulets. It just seemed to me like that was a little bit tacked on.
I completely agree.
Like the adding of the clue cards and the getting of the treasure and that treasure distribution, that in and of itself are good game mechanics and very interesting. You know, adding on the, I guess maybe they just wanted to add in a little bit more of a, maybe another carrot for people to chase, because you got to make a decision as to, do I want to go after this treasure and go this direction, or do I want to get an amulet? Mm. You know, but it just seemed a little bit tacked on to me. It adds some extra complexity that if you're trying to teach a brand new person, I would almost say don't even play with the amulets and maybe
I think they're a bit powerful, honestly.
Oh, I think so,
especially
too.
Tacked with a curse card thing, which I know you're going to get to. I think they're a bit overpowered.
Well, being able to take a second turn and line up a couple of things in a row, like playing a couple of two clue cards, that is a pretty powerful thing. So I'm just not sure if those were necessary. Sure. This isn't like it's not a huge problem. I still liked playing with them, and it was fun, you know, being able to find the right moment to play them. But that was kind of a try point for me.
Yeah.
All right, so now let's just scrape the bottom of the barrel. And what do you have any deny points for this game?
I just have one. It can be pretty fiddly with the cubes. Like if you narrow down a treasure to where just enough to where you can put cubes on the board, but you're putting every cube on the board.
Oh yeah,
that can be kind of fiddly, you know, trying to figure out, you know, you, there's all these, it's like, oh, does it match that, you know, that can kind of slow the game down, maybe even do a little brain burn there. That being said, don't be surprised if this shows up as like an Xbox Live game or some sort of online thing, because I think, now I'm not saying that board games are better online, don't get me wrong, but I think the idea of that kind of auto-calculating thing,
yeah,
this would be that would shorten the game like by half, I would say.
Yeah, like if you're able to say it's not in a scrub land, and all of a sudden the computer goes, and it just, you know, puts, that would be cool, huh?
Yeah, so that can be kind of fiddly, but I bet that leads to some sort of electronic version of it. Just a feeling.
Yeah, good call.
What are your deny points?
Well, I mean, I overall really like this game a lot, but the only thing that I think might be a deny point for some people would be because of the strategies of the treasure distribution and the playing of the clue cards and the amulets, it might be for those who aren't into deep Euro strategy games, who don't like to sit over an Age of Steam board or something like that, you know, and you know, plan out your move 3 or 4 turns in advance or whatever. I think you might find this a little bit brain burny. I just found that Cody says he plays something and he gets that feeling of, oh, this is actually a Euro game in disguise. For me, I always know that something is what I would call a Euro game when there's a lot of silence in a game. That if you're not hooting and hollering or talking or, you know, during a game or you just don't find yourself interacting very much because you're thinking about what you want to do, then that's very Euro-y and heading towards a little bit of brain burn there. So you might not experience that, but if you're not used to more deeper strategy games, that it might, you might feel that way. The other thing is, I really feel the cursed treasure cards are ridiculous. I don't even think they should be in the game. I don't think they should be in the game because I don't see why they add some just kind of a random element. I mean, it's basically just...
That's the Ameritrash hat, my friend. That's the 3D stuff.
I guess so. But if in a game where you are really trying to be strategic and plan things out and do things in the right order, to just have a card that automatically just, you know, wipes away your best treasure card and possibly, depending on when it comes out, it can, you know, maybe you've added 5 clue cards to a particular treasure because you really wanted to get a good draw. Then the first card that comes out is a cursed treasure card and it just ruins it for you.
I'll agree with you there. I don't mind something kind of breaking up the elements there, but now that you've said that, yeah, maybe it's a bit strong, because I was, the game we played, I was cruising early on, and then I lost a sixer to one of those, and I was third place.
So, I mean, I guess it gives you incentive to maybe go after an amulet, make sure that you are balancing your game out and having some amulets to cover that sort of a thing, that contingency. But that was only kind of a deny point. I think maybe I'm just holding a grudge because that one really screwed me in the game that we played. Yeah. But, I mean, what are your overall thoughts on the game?
Like I mentioned ad nauseum, it's a very unique game, and I had a lot of fun with it. It's something I would bring to the table again. It's not my absolute favorite game in the world, but it has merit, and I think a lot of people are actually going to get a lot of fun out of it.
Yeah.
So what'd you think?
I feel the same way. I really did enjoy it, and it's not a real long game, and that's a good thing. It's pretty accessible, I think, especially if you play without the amulets the first time. I think that this can be a family game. I think they say it's for like ages 10 and up. That's probably about right. I think the narrowing things down with those clue cards might be tough for a younger kid to get their brain around. But I just give it an overall good rating. And even though that we lost to your wife, she beat us both.
So she's good.
She's quite good at games, yeah. But anyway, so that's Tobago,
yep.
And another good one from our friends at Rio Grande.
Rio Grande?
Yeah.
And what do you say we close out the show?
Let's do it. Yo, let me take you to a place where the sun shines bright and the people move slow, taking their time, doing their thing from day to day. To Tobago.
Well, that's another great. Well, it's another episode of Game On with Cody and John. We hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to get in contact with us, the now two best ways to do so are to write the Game On inbox at gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Or to check out the Game On voicemail box at 4138 Game On.
That's right.
That's 4138426366.
Well done. And that is the best way to get in contact with us. And we love listener emails and phone calls. It's the part of the job that pays.
That does it?
No, not yet.
Yeah, but it's fun.
That's right.
All right, we also would invite you to check out our website at gameonpodcast.com, where you can find all of our previous episodes and lots of other great stuff and, you know, pretty graphics that Cody has designed. That's always fun to see.
Yep. You can check out our guild on Board Game Geek. We're number 576, or you can just search for Game On with Cody and John.
Yeah, lots of good discussions and conversations going on there.
Game On is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. If you like our shows, you can find similar shows at pulpgamer.com.
We also have a fan page on Facebook where you can search for Game On with Cody and John and join our fan page, and we're also on Twitter at Game On Podcast.
Come be our friend, be our buddy.
That's right. Well, join us in 2 weeks where we're going to be doing an episode about our journey into the world of miniature wargaming.
Yep.
So we'll be giving you a full review of War Machine Mark II from our perspective as new miniatures wargamers, and hopefully we'll open your horizons up to that as well.
Absolutely.
So until then,
Game On.